Hello and welcome to Showing Up with Good Culture. I'm Liz Matthews.
And I'm Jordan Mitchell. Showing Up is a podcast with purpose where we speak to the change makers who are positively contributing to culture to impact the world around them. On this episode, we speak to journalist, photographer, author and advocate, and also my overall just ultimate girl crush, the brilliant Amanda de Cadenet.
Amanda de Cadenet has had a lifelong career in media, starting at just 15 when she became a household name as the host of the biggest live late night music show, The Word. She then presented another of the most iconic shows of all time, The Big Breakfast, leaving at just 19, turning her back on public life and moving to LA. In 2016, Amanda founded Girl Gaze, a platform that connects a network of female-identifying and non-binary creatives with companies who want to hire diverse creative teams.
In 2017, Amanda exec produced and hosted The Conversation, a groundbreaking interview series and podcast featuring female thought leaders and innovators such as Vice President Kamala Harris, Hillary Clinton, Gwyneth Paltrow, Alicia Keys, and Lady Gaga. An accomplished photographer, Amanda has published several books as well as an autobiography called It's Messy.
In 2021, Amanda was announced as a founding member of the New Victoria's Secret Collective alongside Naomi Osaka, Priyanka Chopra Jonas, Megan Rapinoe, Valentina Sampaio, Hailey Bieber, and Bella Hadid. Whew. I feel like I need a cup of tea after that intro. That's the longest intro we've ever done.
That's the longest one.
Whoa. I'm tired. Listening to that.
Oh my goodness. Amanda, thank you for joining us. It is such a privilege to chat to you. And the first question of every episode is, what does showing up mean to you?
Showing up is what life is about. I mean, it absolutely is the cornerstone of what I try to do every day in some capacity. And that for me means showing up for myself primarily. What are the things that I need to do for myself every day so that I can be a parent, so that I can have my career, so that I can be a friend, I can be an advocate, I can be a mentor, I can take care of my kids, I can be a wife. If I don't show up for myself first, then I'm running on an empty tank. And so all of those areas are areas that I attempt to show up in. And some days I do it more successfully than others. But I think being able to show up for yourself, number one, and then all the other aspects of your life is the goal. That's the goal for me.
I think that's brilliant. And I totally agree about you can't do good for others if you're kind of not there supporting yourself. And we've all sort of been in places where we're running through with an empty tank, and you can't show up for anyone when you're like that. But I would say through the work that you've done and historically looking at your kind of career and body of work, you're always showing up for women primarily, but actually marginalized voices as well. And through the work with Girl Gaze, and even when we look at your early work in photography, it was all about kind of showing up for females and for kind of marginalized communities. So where did that sort of impetus and drive from you kind of come from?
That's a really interesting question. And when I think back, I remember being at school when I was, you know, 12 or 13. And I remember the school took me aside and said, we've had some parents that have complained about some of the things you're saying to the girls. Apparently you're encouraging them to speak up about things that are bothering them. And you're encouraging them to talk about things that we just don't think, you know, they should be discussing. And all it was things that were bothering girls at the time. And I felt really passionately about girls having a voice. And I was very aware growing up, maybe it's, I don't know, my dad is a race car driver. It's a predominantly male industry. My dad was the first male race car driver to have a female co-pilot at Le Mans, which is an endurance race. You race for 24 hours at a time. So my dad raised me and my brother without gender differentiation. It was very much like, okay, well, do you want to learn how to ride a motorbike or drive a car? And he taught me and my brother how to do these things. And I didn't grow up with a gender restriction in that regard in my family. But I did once I got into the world, right? So once I got into the world, I realized, oh, women are seen, people want to look at them and appreciate and value their beauty and the outside and their sexuality, but they don't really care what they have to say. And in fact, if you have an opinion and you're beautiful and you're funny and you're strategic or whatever it is, like, that's just too much. You're just not going to be allowed to have that. And so I do think that the 8 months that I spent in White City Children's Home in a juvenile detention center definitely increased my desire to be heard, because I was part of a system in the UK where I was just another kid who was in the system. And it really didn't matter what I had to say about my experience. In fact, I was communicating very clearly what was going on with me, and it just didn't matter. All that was looked at was, this kid is acting out in ways that are unacceptable to society, and therefore we're going to lock her up. So that kind of compounded my desire for the need to be heard. And then I got out and I needed a job, and I auditioned and I got the job hosting The Word, as you mentioned, which became the biggest live late night TV show in the UK. So I went from being in a children's home to hosting live TV within a year and becoming a household name. And that was the first time that I experienced having a voice, because I was literally on TV speaking. And we ran into problems, because pretty soon after I started that job, I was like, I don't want to say your words. I want to say what I want to say. And they were like, no, can you follow the script? I was like, no, I cannot follow the script because I would not say this and I don't think this. And so I think I've had a lot of early experiences. And then my experience with the UK tabloid media, which was, in hindsight, extremely bullying and hostile and aggressive and demeaning, you know, and as a young teen, experiencing the vitriol and the judgment of the UK tabloid media, who are just, you know, unrelenting with their epic criticism of people. At the time, it was me. I think that also really impacted me, because we didn't have social media. And, you know, News of the World or The Sun could run a cover story saying that you had done something when you hadn't, and you had no way to retaliate. You had no way to say, but that's just not true. And so the media was creating a narrative about me which just wasn't accurate. And that really incensed me. And it really fired up my desire even further for women to be heard. And so I think that those experiences really led me to being very committed to, as a photographer, I started being a photographer before we had selfies, because I wanted to document myself. I didn't want other photographers who were men at the time photographing me. I wanted to show myself how I saw me, not how they saw me. And so at the time, my publicist was a guy called Jason Weinberg. That was before Liz was my publicist. But and he said, oh, you always don't like the photographs that people are taking of you. When your next project comes, I think you should just do your own pictures. And so that's how I became a photographer, was through the desire to represent myself, how I see myself through my lens. And that's how my career started. And I always became known as someone who would photograph women authentically. And there were so few female photographers at that time who were successful. It was people like Ellen von Unworth, who's another generation to me, or Inez van Lamswood, who's another generation to me. And then there was older women like Mary Ellen Mark. And there was just such a lack of representation of female perspective across all media. So that kind of fired me up to create Girl Gaze. And I thought, if I'm having the type of limitations that I'm experiencing with female photographers, there's got to be so many other talented girls out there that are just not getting a look in. And so with Girl Gaze, I really leveraged my privilege to get other people in the room. So I think between that and then The Conversation, which, you know, was a groundbreaking show, because it was the most famous women in the world talking about things they had never spoken about before in a very authentic, truthful way. And the goal of that was to connect women and to help people, women, feel less alone. And that was, no one thought I could make that show. No one, and I say this because it's important for people to know that I tried to sell that show and nobody would buy it. They said, no one's going to do this. And so I had to literally make it from my living room myself. And then people were like, oh my God, she did it. Let's buy it. And I was like, yeah, fuck you. I'm not selling it to you now. I'll put it somewhere where I'm given the creative latitude to tell these stories. And so The Conversation also came from a desire to share truthful, real conversation from women. And so all of, I guess my early childhood and then my experience being in the UK and the tabloid media and being a known person since I'm a young person, since I'm a teenager, have gone to shape why I'm very committed to advocating for voices that don't often get a look in. And sadly, that is still women. It is still women, even though we've had a lot of attention on this issue. Not a lot has really changed.
I'm interested to know, I think it was Bustle that described you as a wise older sister. And I think when you look at your life from 15, you're presenting live TV. At 19, you're choosing to get married, have a baby. You're dropping everything, laundry and basket, and moving to another country. You're doing all of that in 4 years, like 15 to 19. That's a title that someone else has given you. Do you consider yourself to be that kind of sister figure to others?
I feel very blessed. I mean, actually, that word blessed is just so overly used and cheesy. I feel very grateful that I have the opportunity to mentor younger women. I was speaking with a woman, well, she's a girl, she's 19 years old. I don't even know her. Somebody that I know said, oh, there's a girl that is trying to get sober and she needs to speak to someone who has similar life experience. Can you call her? I was like, sure. So I call the girl. She's in the UK. I don't know anything about her. And we get on the phone and we start talking. And I was just, you know, so grateful to be able to be a sounding board for her and to know what she was talking about when she was describing some of the things that were going on in her life. And I will say overall, all the things that have happened in my life, the things that have been really, really painful and the things that have been incredible, if you can put those to use to helping other people or to creating value in your life, then it really gives them a second life. You know, it's like, I would say that even though I did choose to get sober as a teenager and I was a mother as a teenager and I had a very big career as a teenager, and it's true, I did leave the UK with food in the fridge and laundry in the hamper. I couldn't tolerate the UK media any longer. My mental health was so incredibly compromised. I had postpartum depression. I was being hounded by the British press every time I stepped out my house. There was cover stories about how fat I was and people trying to get photos of me breastfeeding and just really horrible, critical pieces. And my mental health was really on the decline. And so I had to leave. And I literally from one day to the next left and didn't go back. And I think that there's a lot of things that have happened. By the age of 19, I had experienced two sexual assaults, been in, you know, juvie, had severe drug and alcohol addiction that I almost died from multiple times. And I'm just very fortunate that I'm alive to tell the tale. And I have often wondered, why am I still alive? Because I know a lot of people who didn't make it, who didn't have it any different to me. And I wondered what it is. And I don't really have the answer to the question other than every day, because it is a kind of daily practice for me. I try to put my life experience to good use for other people and not just myself. And that has given me a real purpose, even writing my book, It's Messy. The point of that was to give other women hope and let them know that they can go through things that are really hard and they think will be the end of them, that actually can be the making of them. Everything I do, I try to be rooted in service. Now, I don't know how well that fits into the current paradigm of how our world is constructed, because I don't know how much people, the current currency in the world is not about integrity and being of service. It's about fame and social media followers. That's just it, you know? And that for me is really devastating because it discounts and discredits any of the things that I've spent my life valuing and building, like a life of service and showing up and having integrity and doing the right thing, even if it's really fucking hard, because it's the right thing to do. And I'm constantly faced with, well, that's not the currency in the world, because what the currency is how many numbers are after your social media handle. And so I'm really struggling with the way I've chosen to live my life at times, because I don't know how that fits into the current paradigm. But this is who I am, so I have to accept that.
Well, I think, Amanda, you have always been a trailblazer, and actually some of the themes that you are talking about now, but also the things that you were talking about then, are some of the themes that are only starting to be looked at now. So when you were talking about mental health, and even just your openness, where we're kind of moving to a time, although it's still, you're ahead of the curve, where people are starting to share about, oh, I've suffered from postnatal depression, I've suffered from addiction. People are starting to open up now. And I do think that as the paradigm does shift, and that as a world, we become more empathetic and engaged with feeling beyond the veneer, and that certainly is what we're seeing, I think that you're primed and ready there, because you've been doing this. This isn't just ticking boxes to say, oh, well, I'm going to share my journey now because that's what the currency is, because you've been out here doing the work and sharing that. So I wonder, have you ever felt that kind of openness and that vulnerability? Has that been sort of self-soothing in a way, where you've just sort of laid it out there and exposed yourself, but in doing so, has that also been quite a cathartic healing process for you in just sharing your truth?
Well, it is. I mean, that's the amazing thing. If you look at any of the significant religions in the world, you can pick any of them, Catholicism, Buddhism, Christianity, any of them. As a part of all of those practices, there is a part that involves, you know, community and sharing one-on-one, whether it's with your rabbi or your priest or whoever it is, whatever's going on with you, you know. And I do very much, I'm the product of recovery. I've been in recovery since I'm 19 years old. And in order to stay sober for as long as I have done and to not be a crazy person, I've had to, at an early age, embrace a part of recovery, which is being truthful with yourself and with another person. So it's part of who I am. I'm raised in recovery. You know, I'm literally like the poster child for recovery. And I've been in therapy on and off since I'm 15, actually. I've been in all types of programs and different modalities of treatment. I've done all kinds of trauma treatment. I've done a lot of different things to help, first of all, put myself back together and then keep myself together at different stages of life where I've begun to come apart again, like after my kids were born, and, you know, and in fact, multiple times in my life. So that level of intimate, vulnerable sharing is built into my recovery practice. And I think that there is a danger in oversharing. I think that people use their vulnerable stories sometimes in a way that has ulterior motives. And I see that. And, you know, I'm definitely cautious of that, right? But I also think it's a way that connects us. It does connect us.
I read that in, I think it was a Brené Brown, Daring Greatly, where she talks about that oversharing of vulnerability to fast track connection and being hyper aware and vigilant of, like you say, authentic sharing. And when people share for an kind of ulterior motive to sort of, you know, get something on their own.
Yeah, I mean, Brené Brown is also in recovery. So a lot of what you see in her work comes from her own recovery journey. And, you know, and I connect with her work a lot. I think she's phenomenal. And she's someone that's also been in recovery for a long time. But yeah, that kind of oversharing. I mean, I've had mental health issues since I was 15 years old. And I self-medicated with drugs and alcohol. And medication did not work, and they didn't have advanced medication at that time. And so, you know, at 19 years old with severe postpartum, there was not a lot that can help me. And that's actually why I did an episode on postpartum on the conversation with Gwyneth Paltrow, because I knew that she had postpartum as well. And people just weren't talking about it. I think Brooke Shields was like the first famous person to talk about it. And it was like a big deal, you know, and now people talk about it more, which is great. It's great. But, you know, I think there's also a danger in sharing too vulnerably with the wrong people, because people will form a judgment, and not everyone is a safe space. So I do try to keep, you know, there are some things that have happened in my life that no one will know about other than the people who are involved. And there's quite a lot of them. So even though I am a very open book and there's enough of the stuff out there, There are just as many things that I keep private that I do not discuss because it wouldn't be appropriate.
I would like to know, where does your natural kind of curiosity of people come from? Because it's not just, you know, your network of famous friends, it's the everyday person. You are so interested in people. We've set up Zoom calls before with all manner of different, from journalists to, you know, people at brands to friends, and you seem to be as interested in everybody's story as everybody else. And the second part of that question is, what about you makes some of the most famous women in the world want to come to your house, sit on your sofa, and tell you their most intimate things and stories and things that they wouldn't share on, you know, normal chat shows? Why do they feel safe with you, do you think?
Well, I think, so the first part of that question is, why, you know, where's my curiosity come from? And I think I really am genuinely interested in people and about what makes people the way they are. I mean, I'm fascinated. I've been reading psychology books since I was a teenager, and I've read, you know, most of the great books, and I've worked, you know, and studied and taken courses in different psychology modalities, different trauma treatments. I'm really, really fascinated with human beings. And I have an endless supply of empathy for people, which is actually very dangerous for someone like me, because I can get derailed emotionally when I'm too affected. Like, the war in Ukraine right now is really messing me up. And I have to be really careful that I don't ignore what's going on, but I don't take it on too much. Otherwise, I'm in tears all day and I'm not doing enough and I've got to help more and what can I do? And that's just not a healthy place to be in. So, and I think the reason why people are comfortable, whether they be people who are normally quite protective about themselves because they're high profile people, or, you know, Jane Doe, is because I'm coming from a place of true curiosity and respect. I really am not interested in what the salacious thing is. And I actually don't care. And I've come to real conflict when I've had shows and somebody that I know is in the news for something salacious. And the network has said, when you interview Selena Gomez, you've got to talk to her about Justin Bieber. And I'm like, absolutely not. Absolutely not. There's not a hope in hell I'm talking to her about why she's broken up with her partner. I know the answer to the question, by the way, but I'm not going to speak to her about that. A, it's disrespectful to speak to a woman about their partner. And B, that's her business. So let someone else ask that. I'm not interested in talking to people about the traumatic things in their lives until they're out of the trauma on the other side. Because ultimately, there's no wisdom to be shared when you're in it. You're just trying to stay alive. You don't know which way is up. And so my objective with interviewing people is to connect people and to help people to feel less alone and to share wisdom. That's my objective.
I think that's, you know, because you didn't have form. When you were interviewing in the early days, when I wonder whether your own experience of how you were treated gave you that empathy and made you want to be kinder to others. I mean, so recently, via VS, so you've been brought on to host the VS Voices podcast, Bella Hadid, who is such a famous face and such a famous figure, gave you her first ever podcast. She'd never done a podcast before, and she trusted you. And I know you spoke offline and you made her feel safe and comfortable, and you were so careful and kind with her. And it was a really emotional interview because you could just tell that she trusted you. And do you still get a kick from speaking to people like that? Did that mean something to you, to be the first person for her to speak to like that?
It means something to me every time someone trusts me with their story. And I take it very seriously. And I always want to protect them and always want them to feel that they are being valued and that their intimate personal journey, which is a very vulnerable one, and in the case of Bella, it was very vulnerable. And in the case of Naomi Osaka, that was the first interview Naomi had done since she had pulled out of the French Open, and we talked about mental health as well and her journey with that. And I feel very privileged to be able to be the conduit for those stories. And I just take it really seriously. I really do value it. And so it's a responsibility. And once that story is given to me, it's my responsibility to make sure that how it is edited, how it's marketed, is done in accordance with what that person's wishes are. It means it's a lot more work for me. I'm probably a bit more difficult to deal with on the other side of it because I'm very strict about how it's, you know, I've got to listen to the edit. In fact, I do the paper cut myself to make sure there's no room for error. And then once everyone's given their notes, I listen to it again. So that thing is not going out the door until I've heard it. And then it goes out the door, because if the wrong thing gets out there and that person is not represented with care, it will be my responsibility. Even though ultimately it's not, like logistically, it is, because they trusted me. They didn't trust my editor or the social team or whatever. They trusted me. They gave me that content and that story. So it does mean something to me every single time. And Liz, you're right. I've been interviewed. I've been on the other side of it so many times, and I have been fucked over and exploited so many times that it is my ultimate nightmare for anyone to ever feel like that I am a part of that with them. And so I really do go to all lengths to make sure that that is not the person's experience in any way, shape, or form. And I'll take things out of an edit that I know will be big headlines, because I know that it will be too exposing for the person, even if they don't ask me to. You know, like I got offered an interview the other day that is a huge interview. And I said to my husband, I was like, oh my God, this person asked me to do this interview with them. And I just don't think I can do the interview. And he said, why wouldn't you? That's going to be massive. And I said, because it's too complicated. I'm going to have to ask them questions that are way too difficult for them to answer in their first interview about this subject matter. Because if I don't ask those questions, I'll be considered that I've been light on them, and I cannot be light on them. It was someone who had a kind of very public Me Too situation. And I said, look, I'm not the best person to interview you for this because I'm going to have to ask you really hard things. You can't answer these at this point. And you're going to have to, I'm going to push you on stuff that is going to be well past your comfort zone. You know, and I appreciate you coming to me, but like, I just cannot.
That goes back to integrity, though.
That's what I'm saying. I'm really struggling with, does my integrity get in the way of my career? I do wonder if my kind of commitment to like doing what's right gets in the way of opportunity. And I think it does. But like, I have to be okay with that because that's the way it is.
I think one of the points about kind of that intersection between integrity and legacy is really important, because there are lots of people in this world, like actually even going back a bit, when you think in 200 years, none of us are going to be here. None of us are going to be here apart from the legacy we leave behind. And I think unless you have integrity, the things that are left behind doesn't matter. It doesn't mean anything. You know, if you're just that person that says yes to any job, that does anything, that doesn't have any value, that doesn't really stand for anything, doesn't stand up for others, actually the legacy you leave behind is just someone that was just didn't really care. So I think to say no to more things and to do things that matter just means that you're passing on a legacy that hundreds
of years...
Well, that
is showing up for yourself.
That's showing up for yourself.
That is showing up for yourself. I'm interested to, because your audience, Amanda, is so vast and varied. Like, you cannot define your audience. You have, you know, the Gen Z audience, which are, you know, actually probably share some of the same attributes as you do. This whole girl gaze phenomenon that started as a hashtag and is now this global network that you've helped so many, and you've helped fund it. And I know how hard that's been, and you've never given up. What connects you to that generation? Because, I mean, it's like the elixir that every brand wants to know how to talk to those people. And quite a lot of brands patronize them and get it so, so, so wrong. You've got women your own age, you've got men, you've got such a cross-section. But what do you think specifically is about the Gen Z girl gaze community that, you know, that draws them to you?
I mean, I think fundamentally, I have leveraged my privilege to get other people in the room. And in the beginning of Girl Gaze, the first kind of 150 women and non-binary folk who were in our community. I knew every single one of them. And I was kind of like this glorified agent, you know, and I was really helping get people jobs, you know, and people would reach out to me to do something and say, look, I can't do this, but you should hire so-and-so. And we had one girl who was living in her car who is now shooting like Megan Thee Stallion's, you know, album cover. And we've got another girl who was on food stamps who, I mean, I'm pretty sure has a way bigger career than I would ever have at this point as a photographer. And she's so good. I mean, I'm so proud of her. And she was the one person whose work is quite similar to mine. So whenever I couldn't do something, I would say, you should hire so-and-so. And I vouch for her. She's really good. And I think that most people, and I will say this, that I've received a lot of thanks and gratitude from many of the people in the Girl Gaze community. And what I always say is this, you're thanking me for the opportunity to be seen. That's all I did. But if you didn't have your talent, you would not be where you are today. And one of the biggest limitations for creative people and especially marginalized communities is the barriers to entry. It's just not being seen, not being able to get in front of someone. Because I look at people's work and I'm like, this person is fucking amazing. They're directing, they're editing, their animation, their illustration, their photography, whatever it is. I look at the work, I'm like, there's no way this person wouldn't get hired. But guess what? They're not getting seen because of the systemic exclusion and the way the infrastructure is built. And so what Girl Gaze did is it removed all those barriers, right? It you don't have to be represented by a photo agent or an art agent or whatever. You don't have to be able to get into an agency, right? Get in front of an agency. You need an agent to get into an agency who own the jobs for you to get booked. We removed all of that. The people who have the money, the brands are the patron saints of the arts. We gave them the keys to the creative community and said, here you go, hire who you want. And guess what? You don't have all those markups. You don't have all those hidden fees. And you can actually hire more people to do what you need to do. And we've already curated the community for you. So you're not getting a bunch of people who can't cut it. You've got people who can be hired. And so I think my genuine care for this generation to have a different experience than me, because I, as a female photographer and a female creative, did not get anyone helping me. Nobody helped me. Nobody called me and said, listen, I got you a job. I got you a job. No, that did not happen to me. I had to fight and push and create space where there was none for me. The only jobs I got given was doing self-portraits. I would be on the cover of a magazine and I would say, I'd say to the editor-in-chief, can you put me in touch with your photo editor? And they'd be like, why? I'd say, because I want to see if they'd give me a job as a photographer. And, you know, none of them would. They were just like, why would you not want to be a famous person? Why do you want to be a photographer? And it was because I had more to say. And I just didn't want the next generation to have the same limitations I did. Because I do feel like there's such a waste of talent and expression. And certainly my kids are Gen Z, and the tools that this generation have to create. I mean, Ella, my daughter, is a photographer. And she just showed me her photos the other day. 4 or 5 days a week, she's doing photo shoots. I'm not allowed to come in and see. I don't know what she uses. I know that she uses all my old film cameras and my old 80s VHS camcorder. And finally, I said, you know, can I see something? And she was like, no. And I was like, I really just want to see your work. And she showed me. And I was so blown away. And then a girlfriend of mine, who's one of the biggest Gen Z, you know, music stars who loves Ella, was over at my house and was like, oh my God, do you think she'd do a video for me? And I was like, well, that's privilege. That is privilege. That access that you just got is only because of my relationship. And my daughter is so against leveraging privilege of her parents of any kind that she won't actually do anything that involves levering privilege. But when it comes to Girl Gaze, because they've all got tools, their creative expression is phenomenal. And I honestly want them to have a different experience than I did, because it shouldn't be that way. It should be, again, it shouldn't be how many social media followers you have is what gets you the job. It should be your talent. And I hope, and I've said it so many times to the Girl Gaze community, your talent is what will make you succeed. I don't know if that's necessarily true anymore. And that is what I'm really struggling with personally at the moment. But I intend to keep supporting talent as much as I can.
You mentioned some really interesting themes there around privilege and how you're raising your family to be aware of that, but also it's that kind of education. I think now we're having these sorts of real live conversations where we're all understanding what privilege is. And even when you spoke earlier about what's going on in the Ukraine, I think why also it's so poignant is because that just represents it could happen to anyone. And war is happening everywhere and anywhere. But it, you know, that feeling of we could all be so vulnerable to that and those sorts of themes. So one of the things that you had mentioned in a previous interview was about financial autonomy and that being something that was incredibly important to you from a super young age. Is that something that you instill in your children? Because I guess, obviously, their situation is different. They are growing up in a household of really accomplished parents and you know, access to pop star videos and all of that sort of thing. How are you instilling that sort of level of financial autonomy and responsibility that comes with that?
I mean, my kids are really unhappy about the financial restrictions they have because they have a budget and we've mapped out what their costs are every month, from their shampoo to their Postmates to their Starbucks to their toothpaste, whatever it is, deodorant, whatever it is. We've done a monthly budget, and what my responsibility to pay for as their parent is factored in that budget. And then anything that is above and beyond that, they have to earn. So it's like, look, I'll pay for like one Starbucks a week. And if you want more, that's up to you. Like, this is your budget and this is what you're agreeing to. And I think it's really important, even though they've got parents that have unusual jobs. And, you know, my kids in the last few years have only just realized that their dad is in a huge band. And they've been going to stroke shows since they were babies. And, you know, until they became teenagers and one of the Strokes songs got huge on TikTok and suddenly all their friends loved the Strokes. And then they were a bit more interested in what their dad did. But I remember the first time when they went to a Strokes concert and they were like, oh, gosh, you know, our dad is a successful guitar player in a band that's successful. And I thought, how great that they're 13, 14 years old and that they haven't grown up with this entitled, arrogant perspective. You know, like, how great that they're just realizing this. Because, you know, also credit to my husband, he's the most down to earth, you know, not rock-star-y rock star that there is. And I think it's the way that we are as well. It's like, we do this for a job. We love what we do. We feel very, very grateful. If you can get paid to do what you love and that's your job, you're winning. You're winning. And that's why I'm always so grateful for the opportunity to do what I love. And I think that kind of perspective, just, you know, our kids are very grounded and they're so adverse to privilege. It's quite fascinating, actually. My daughter's like, no, I don't want someone to pick me. You know, sometimes I'm like, look, I can't drive you everywhere all day. You know what I mean? Like, someone else is going to have to pick you up. And she's like, that is just so privileged. And I'm like, fine, take the bus. And you know what? She takes the goddamn bus.
I'm here for it.
Wow. LA doesn't even have a transport system. This girl takes the bus and the metro line.
Wow.
To go to school. Ella. She's like, fine, I will. I wouldn't even know how to do it in LA. But that's Ella. Because she's like, no, I've got it. I'll get on the bus. I wouldn't put Sylvan on the bus, by the way. I'd never see him again.
So we're going to move on. We've got a bunch of community questions. I actually stole this idea from you, Amanda, because you always do this. You always go, I'm going to talk about whatever. What do you want me to ask? What do you want to know? So we did the same thing. So the first one is, a lot of women in midlife feel invisible. And do you feel that, as somebody that is in their 40s, do you feel that you are being less and less heard? Are you finding having a broad spectrum of women as friends of different ages helpful for the next chapter, what comes when our kids leave home, which for both of us is not too far in the future? What do you feel about this sort of statement that middle-aged women feel invisible, or that there is this huge shift. We know about the menopause, but there's this shift in not being seen or heard. Are you worried about that? I don't think you are, but are you worried about that?
I mean, I'm not really in it yet. You know, I'm getting close to it, and it's something that I have to give more thought and attention to. You know, I really hope, I mean, listen, you know, beauty, the beauty card only lasts so long. It just does. And I've always said that to Atlanta, my daughter, who's turning 30 in a couple of weeks. And I, you know, I know you both know her. And I've always said to Atlanta, who's one of the most beautiful girls, and I don't just say that because she's my daughter, she really is. And ever since she was a baby, I said to her, listen, you better have something more to contribute than just the way you look, because your looks will get you in the room, but what you have to say is what keeps you in the room. And so I'm banking on that being true. Yeah. I'm hoping that that is true. And, you know, talk to me in a couple of years and I'll give you an update on that one.
Okay. Another question is, this is a good one. Do you think your younger self would be proud of you?
Yes, definitely. Because my younger self didn't want to live. So,
yeah. Wow.
I mean, that's the truth.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we are very proud of you too.
Oh, wow.
Thank you.
Got the stingers. Well, one more from the community, then we'll go to you, because this is actually quite funny. So Amanda always has this same background. We speak quite a lot for work, and also the podcast, and you're always in your specially set up studio. This person wants to know, how many of the books behind you have you actually read?
Oh, that's cheeky.
That's a great question. That's a great question. A lot of them are photography books. So I have looked at, I would say, maybe 3/4 of them.
Wow.
Because I'm an avid studier. So I have actually, if I had to read all of them, but I'm also a crazy reader. One of my biggest fears is that I'm not going to be able to read all the books I want in my life. That's one of my biggest fears, because I love reading and I've learned so much from books.
Final question for me. What do you love about yourself now that perhaps growing up you didn't love about yourself?
Oh my God.
So a quality that you have now that actually you embrace, whereas before you may have pushed against it.
I mean, a quality that I have now. I'm trying to think of what quality I didn't have when I was younger. I feel like I've just developed the qualities that are really beneficial and tried to diminish the ones that aren't. Well, I would say consistency. It was very difficult for me to be consistent because I was so reactive to everything. And I didn't have as much agency over my emotions. And so I was getting, I would emotionally respond to things that would then take me off track for, it could be weeks, you know? And so I would say consistency and more agency over my responses to things. That's something that's developed later in life. And that's given me more control over where I want to spend my time emotionally. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
It makes total sense.
Total sense.
Well, we always end this podcast because I think showing up is such a broad term, and everybody that we've asked for their interpretation of it has answered differently. Mm-hmm. Just to make it real simple, what can the average Joe do in their lives at home to make more of a positive contribution? How can people show up?
I think you have to, my recommendation or my suggestion would be to find something that's personal to you. I would do one thing for yourself that is nurturing, whatever that is, whether that is to have a bath, lay in bed, read a book, go to the park, take a nap, stay up and watch a documentary, whatever it is, like do something that is nurturing for yourself, show up for yourself. And then spend the time to really think about if you've got any extra energy after you've taken care of your life and you first, then look at where are the areas that you feel connected to. It could be a very, very quiet pull towards something. And it doesn't matter if it's not activism. It could be that you're really interested in cooking, in which case find out where you can go cook. Is there a shelter? Is there an orphanage? Is there a school that, you know, you could go and cook meals once a week or whatever it is? Like really listen to that quiet voice that lets you know what you feel connected to, and then find a way to show up in that area, because from that little quiet space, it will open a door.
That's beautiful.
Great advice.
Amanda, thank you so much for being so generous with your journey and showing up with
us
today.
Welcome.
And it's meant a lot.
Of course. Thanks for asking me.
I mean, I know we say this every time about how generous everyone's being, but I am overwhelmed by how our friends and clients and people known to us are just opening up
showing
up for us, but also for our community of growing listeners. We got our listener stats through today and we have listeners, people.
We have, and it's not just our mum.
It's not just our mum.
I agree. And I think that you call a podcast showing up, you got to come and do just that. But everybody's interpretation is just so different. And this idea of showing up for yourself first,
yeah,
before you can do that for anybody else, is so interesting. And actually just the simplicity at which she described what that means. It's a bath. It's literally, you know, saying yes to a yoga class or just going for a walk or like drinking a cup of tea in peace. It's not big stuff, but it sets you in the right frame so that you can show up for others, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think it's destigmatizing the notion of just rest as well. Like, we kind of beat ourselves up all the time feeling like we should always be like pushing forward, doing something, being busy.
Yeah.
And actually, like, I remember there was a time earlier on, was it this year or last year? You're like, I just needed to go in the garden and put my hands in soil.
Yeah.
In the middle of the day.
I needed to do that.
And I didn't need to be judged. I just needed to do that.
I did that. And you know what? If we weren't each other's bosses, or we didn't have that kind of situation, if I had worked for somebody, mm-hmm. I remember vividly, it was like it wasn't like end of work, but I had an overwhelming desire I guess it's connection.
Mm-hmm.
And I did do that weird thing, and it's not kind of, it made me feel better. So that's
how you show up.
Yeah, that is how you show up. I also loved what she said about, God, what a life she's led. She's led five lives, but
that's
phenomenal.
That real recognition of privilege and power and using that to help and facilitate other people. And I just think that is the greatest and, like you say, a luminous example of showing up.
Yeah.
So, wow.
Lucky bloody us. Lucky well, us. Thank you so much for listening. And it's great to know that some people are listening. That is enough to spur us on.
Do you think now that we have listeners, we should say the like, subscribe,
well,
download?
Do you know what? I'm starting to realise why people say that. So yeah, like, subscribe, download, do all the things.
Rate.
Don't know. But honestly, thank you. This has been such a wonderful sort of experiment and journey. And we're so lucky that we've got amazing supporters and women that want to kind of talk to us. You're not going to believe who we've got coming up. I'm not going to say because
don't
I'm not
spoil
a spoiler.
It, yes.
But stay bloody tuned, because these guests just keep coming and everybody's saying yes to us. So, you know, we need
to watch out. Lock your doors. We're coming for you.
Okay. It's been Liz and Jordan on the Showing Up podcast. See you next time.
Bye-bye.